Touch is the provocative title of a new novel for young adults. It refers to something that's happened at the back of a school bus to the narrator, a ninth grader named Maisie.
It's weirdly hard to sort them out, the story and the truth. Even though I was physically there, the only thing I understand now, which I didn't know before, is how confusing it can be. I mean, the whole question of what's true, what's a lie, what you think, what you say, and what you start to believe.
The author of Touch is Francine Prose. She's written 18 novels. This is her third for young adults. She says she found the voice for Maisie by thinking about how she was at that age.
Independent, tough. I mean, she's a little smarter, I think, than I was, but a real spirit, a real little girl spirit. And what happens is what happens, of course, to little girls, which is she suddenly grows up. I mean, the book is as much about as it is about anything, the kind of shock of finding yourself suddenly a different person, even though you think of yourself as the same person, but how startling it is to realize that you're living in a different body than you had 6 months before.
And in her case, the physical transformation happens very quickly. It happens in a year when she has gone away. Her parents are divorced, and she's gone to live with her mother. It turns out to be a bad idea, and she comes back home. And she's completely different. She looks completely different.
Well, she's grown breasts in the interim, which, again, somehow, you know, you grow up and you kind of take it for granted that that's what happened to you. That's what happens. It's the natural process. But you look different. People treat you differently. And what happens to her is the shock of being treated differently by boys who were just her pals and her buddies. And suddenly, because she has this new, more womanly body and has gone through these changes, suddenly they're boys and girls instead of all just being kids together.
This all reaches a turning point on a school bus ride. And why don't you talk about, as much as you feel comfortable talking about without giving too much away, why don't you talk about what happens on the bus that is the essence of this story?
Mm-hmm. Well, something happens. That's sort of the mystery of the story, which gets resolved. There's an incident involving, as I think it's called, inappropriate touching. Maisie and these boys with whom she's friends, they grope her, I suppose you could say. And because there's such an element of betrayal and personal history, and because they've been friends, as I said, just kids, and suddenly it becomes more and more fraught with rumor, with innuendo, with gossip. It goes through the school. Maisie has a stepmother who wants to make a legal case out of this. So, and I looked into, in fact, I mean, the whole issue of peer sexual harassment, which is an issue in schools, comes into play, and there's a lawsuit and so forth. So all these things are a result of kids playing around in the back of a school bus, which has suddenly taken on new meaning.
For Maisie, this becomes a case where there are many versions of what happened on the bus, including several versions that she's told herself, and she's trying to sort through at some point what she really believes. How did you come to that, as thinking that this is really one of the central questions of this book for her?
I was thinking about the way in which, if you tell a story that is not exactly true, or sort of how you remember something or has some relation to the truth, that lie or half-truth takes on a life of its own until eventually, after years or after months or after weeks, it's hard to tell the difference. I mean, it's, in a way, people have that all the time. I mean, that is, you hear some story about your childhood or you remember it and you start to tell that story, and your telling of the story eventually becomes more real than the thing that actually happened. Well, that's what happens to Maisie kind of in a more concentrated version. I mean, she tells a story of what happens. Then her stepmother kind of wants to believe something else happened. Then it turns out that the boys have said that something completely else happened, and she tells yet another version in response to her hurt and betrayal at what the boys have said.
Throughout this story, Maisie is, she's tough. She's also really vulnerable. She's funny in a lot of places. She's got a wry sense of humor. Would you find yourself, as you write, having her say things that you would then realize that, you know, a 13-year-old just wouldn't say that? That wouldn't be part of her vocabulary. She wouldn't phrase things the way I might have if this were an adult character.
That's something that people say and that I hear. But my own experience of having kids and being around kids is that I was always being shocked. I mean, sometimes your 13-year-old would sound like a 3-year-old, and sometimes your 13-year-old would sound like a 43-year-old. And I was never sure what was going to come out of their mouths, because it never sounded to me exactly like, oh, that's how a 13-year-old sounds. There's such a range.
And she, Maisie, seems sort of world-weary in her own way. She talks about her stepmother, and there's just no love lost there. Her stepmother, Joan, and she says, Joan is constantly auditioning for a TV series being filmed inside her own head. She calls it the Joan Channel.
Yeah. Well, 13-year-olds are smart. That's certainly what I remember, and that's what I've been observing. It's just how quick and observant they are. And again, for me, it was the interest in writing this story and writing about that age. That is, you reach an age, especially if you're a girl, at which your intelligence is no longer valued as much as your body, you know, your physical attributes. But that's kind of what happens.
You know, there was something that disturbed me by the end of this book, which is that it seems to me that at the end, Maisie has lost something irrevocably. She's lost her best friends. She's learned what it means to grow up. She's learned something about the truth. But to me, she ends up losing a lot of things along with that. Is that how you see
that
transition?
That's how I see it. That is how I see it. And that's, in a way, again, how I remember it. I mean, I remember when I was a little kid, you know, I was good at sports and I could jump off the high board, and I was kind of, because I was the oldest, kind of the boss of my block in a certain way. And then puberty hit and suddenly I was like looking to boys for direction. And I remember that as a great loss. I still have to work my way back to where I was at 13. So I remember that as having happened.
Did you struggle with that? Did you think about, you know, do I need to have something more affirmative here to give Maisie a more positive future as this book ends?
Well, she will have one. She will have one. I mean, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't project that far in the future. I mean, my own experience, again, is you do get over it. But again, I wanted to be true to the characters and true to the experience. And I think that when you're that age, I think you're confronted with what you've lost before you can realize what you've gained.
That's a painful thing to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As the mother of a young daughter.
Well, sure. I have a granddaughter now, so I'm about to go through it all over again with her. So, well, you know, she has a while yet, but I can see it coming in the future.
Francine Prose, thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Francine Prose is the author of Touch. You can read an excerpt at npr.org.
The story is as old as the amphitheater. Girl meets boy from a rich and powerful family. Boy marries girl. Man cheats, gets caught. Woman divorces man. Woman gets even. The new novel, Queen Takes King, is the latest variation on that theme from Gigi Levangie-Grazer. Her first book, The Starter Wife, became a TV series. A second novel, Maneater, became a Lifetime miniseries. But this new one moves from the hills of Hollywood to the avenues of Manhattan. Gigi is in our New York bureau. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why move location from the known territory of Beverly Hills to Park Avenue?
You know, I was, let me just be frank, I was tired of Hollywood. I was just tired of it. After I had written two books about, actually three, my first one was Rescue Me, but that was a more serious take on coming-of-age story in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
My second and third one dealt with Hollywood and its environs. And when I was done with those, I felt that I was done with Hollywood itself in that, you know, I'd go to a 500-person valet party for Easter, and I couldn't write about it anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I just didn't have it in me.
Exhausted.
The satire was exhausted, and so it was stone cold reality, and I was finished. Mm-hmm. And we moved. My husband at the time, moved to New York. He had to make a movie, and I thought, why not choose this time to delve into New York and society there.
You moved to New York with your then husband. Your then husband,
yes.
And is Hollywood producer Brian Grazer?
I call Brian. I love him. I call him my husband because I think that sounds nicer.
Oh,
doesn't it?
That's what you have your character calling her.
Yes.
Husband, the husband.
The husband, not the ex.
Okay, now go back to the time when it wasn't as you weren't as nice to one another, and
oh,
you began to write when you broke up. Was there a line between personal and private? Were there things about that relationship that you considered verboten as inspiration for fiction?
Oh, that's That's so interesting because people assume that I wrote The Starter Wife when we had trouble in our marriage, and that wasn't true at all. Mm. Because, as you know, The Starter Wife is about divorce in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. a powerful couple breaking up. This was long before we had any, you know, I mean, I'm sure there was an inkling probably more on his side than mine, but I didn't know that we were going to break up. I just had this character in mind. Oh. And I guess I always did. I'd have girls' nights at my house, and I could see that other women really wanted to be in the position of the producer's wife. I mean, I loved Brian, but I could see what they wanted. They wanted the setting, the garden, the staff, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. I was not really, that's not my orientation. Mm-hmm. I feel that it's much more important to do what you want in life, to find your own way. I come from generations of women who worked, and in some cases, the husbands didn't. So I come from a very powerful line of a matriarchal society.
Yeah.
So I don't relate. I didn't relate to Brian on that level.
Do you see this as a product almost? It's kind of a guilty pleasure, a little like soap opera and paperback romance novels. Even this Queen Takes King. I mean, it's, uh-huh. you know, it's, you're reading it and it's like, you know, it keeps going. It's a page turner.
Mm-hmm. Well, with all my books, except for probably Maneater, I just knew this character. And I had seen her. I had seen her in a composite of different women in L.A. I saw how they went after men. And one woman I know had already planned her wedding without the groom. And then she picked the groom to fit what she had in mind for the wedding. Mm. And I hadn't grown up with people like this. I mean, I grew up, you know, sort of quote-unquote on the wrong side of the tracks. And in fact, my father wouldn't even let me step foot in Beverly Hills because he thought I'd be arrested because I didn't have any money. I wasn't wearing the right clothes and that sort of thing. Beverly Hills terrified me. I feel like I'm a person and still I have issues with it, who is on the outside looking in. And so it's not just a group of, you know, a gaggle of girls with their designer dresses and everything. What makes them tick? That's what interests me. I mean, I'm a girl. I've been reading. I read Dear Abby from the time I was 6 years old. People's problems interest me. Human interest stories consume me. It's not just the action. It's what happened beforehand. Especially with Queen Takes King, I wanted to write a love story about the nature of love and how you can fall in love and it changes everything in your life. And in fact, there are chemical changes in your brain that happen when you're in the state of infatuation. It's a drugged state. And I wanted to write about that. But of course, what happens with me, and this is what happens in my life, is I can't help but make it funny. And that's just who I am. I mean, I can have... There have been tragic moments in my life, and if I wait long enough, it becomes a joke. Mm-hmm. And that's how I deal with life.
Gigi Lavangi-Grazer's new novel is Queen Takes King. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and she joined us from New York. Thanks a lot. Good luck with this.
Thank you so much, Leanne.
That climate change bill was hailed as a step in the right direction by foreign ministers from the world's eight largest economies meeting in Italy this weekend. At that G8 conference, the U.S. unveiled a new strategy to fight the drug trade in Afghanistan. For years, Washington targeted poppy farmers. Now, U.S. Envoy Richard Holbrook says that approach failed, and the new focus will be on shutting down the opium labs. Meanwhile, a new book about Afghanistan takes us back to 1986, when that country was occupied by the Soviet Union. French photographer Didier Lefebvre followed a group from Doctors Without Borders as they crossed into Afghanistan illegally to staff a field hospital. It's been nearly a quarter century since that journey, and Lefebvre died in 2007, but his photos have just been published in the English edition of an unusual book called The Photographer. It's unusual because only part of the story is told through Lefebvre's stark photography. gaps in the narrative are filled in by cartoons, comic strip drawings. Now, before we hear how that book came together, let's start with the journey. Juliette Forno led the Doctors Without Borders mission that Lefebvre documented. I asked her how the photographer came to join her team.
He entered Doctors Without Borders network through his previous profession, which was being a pharmacist and a biologist. And then incidentally, he started allowing himself to develop his other passion, which was photography. This transition in his career was accepted, and that's why I asked him to join our mission with the specific assignment of documenting the difficulties of providing healthcare in a war zone and in a remote area like Afghanistan.
Didier Lefebvre was a very young, inexperienced journalist at the time. Was he prepared for what he was about to encounter?
Probably the difficulty for Didier was to have himself and his role be understood by the Afghans. For the Afghan, it was easy to understand our role as medical providers. Didier was taking pictures, but the Afghans could recognize the necessity of testimony, and the book talks about that, the witnessing, the important aspect of witnessing. But on a day-to-day basis, like when Didier insisted to come back on his own, he wasn't getting favored treatment like we, the medical teams, would probably have gotten.
At the end of the book, we learn about the story of how Didier Lefebvre decides to return to Pakistan. He's run out of film. He's been on the road for 3 months, and he's tired of it. So he decides to go on his own without your team. What happened when he told you he was planning to do this? What was your reaction?
I was upset because I didn't like it when one of my team members, for their own private psychological needs, might be putting the mission in danger. And I always had in mind that if someone is killed, it does jeopardize the whole program. So that was a dilemma, you know, respecting Didier's soul search and trying to keep him safe so that the overall program would not be jeopardized.
Didier Lefebvre barely survived that harrowing journey out of Afghanistan. And when he returned to France, he only published 6 out of the 4,000 photos he had snapped. The rest of them sat in boxes for years. That is, until one fateful day when Lefebvre got to talking with his friend, the graphic artist Emmanuel Guibert.
We were friends, as you said, and I spent one day, an afternoon at his house after a good lunch, and I said, please, choose a mission among all those you have made in the past and tell it to me. And he showed me the contact sheets, and at the end of this afternoon, I had the feeling I had seen something like a still movie. And I said, well, the blanks between the pictures, maybe I could try to fill them up myself with my drawings.
The blanks in the stories that he was telling you.
Yeah. And so that's what I proposed him.
There's a real contrast between the drawings and the photos, but it really works. For example, there's a scene when the medical team is charging into the darkness, and they're portrayed in comic form until the dawn breaks. And then with that light, the page just sort of transforms into these vivid photographs of this very brutal landscape. How did you and Didier figure out what to turn into a drawing and what to keep as a photograph?
The photographs were like the spine of the story. In the beginning, I was thinking that my drawings maybe should look like the photographs to mix, to meld perfectly with them. But it was a mistake. I started to draw in black and white with scales of gray using ink, etc., or pencil. And then I realized I was wrong. So I went back to this very simple style with simple features, simple lines. And I had the feeling that it worked much better.
Emmanuel Guibert, Didier Lefebvre died young of heart failure before he could see this book published into English. But he left thousands of other photographs from other parts of the world. Do you think it would be possible to create this type of book based on another one of his journeys without him being there to describe what happened?
The answer is yes, because he wrote a lot during his missions. He always had with him little notebooks that he filled up. And with the notes that he left, I'm going to try in the future to knit together his words and his photographs to create new books about the missions that we haven't seen anything about.
Emmanuel Guibert wrote and illustrated The Photographer. Juliette Forneau led the Doctors Without Borders mission that Didier Lefebvre photographed in 1986 during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you, bye.
Pleasure for me.
You can see a page from The Photographer. It's one of our recommended books of summer at npr.org.